And there's tonight's party, a roundtable discussion, and welcome aboard. It is May 27th, Saturday, springtime here in the Ozarks. I'm going to be joined here with a couple other folks in just a moment. All right, here we are, and we're joined by, who are we joined by?
Well, you have an introduction? I just walked in.
Yeah, I already did the introduction.
Okay, well, this is Jason Robb, and I have my two boys here. Boys, what's your names?
Caleb Robb.
So we have Caleb Robb and what?
Tayton Robb.
And Tayton Robb. Caleb is 11 years old, and Tayton is 8 years old.
Going on 18.
Going on to 18. And then who else do we have?
Brendan Warner.
Brendan, yes.
All right. So it is May 27th.
27th?
It is. And so we're gathered here for the ninth party roundtable discussion. And I saw a couple of things on the internet this morning. I don't know if you saw anything that you want to talk about or you thought was interesting. But what I saw was kind of humorous. It was one of these stupid, I don't know where it came onto, how it popped up. It was not a news story. You know how news stories have all of the other things you click onto? This was how LGBT couples can show us how to love again.
How to love again. Yeah, pretty gross.
Yeah, anyway. And then it'll show some famous Hollywood couples that are queer and teaching us how to have love, how to love again.
Well, that might be in conjunction with the transgender community. I know in San Francisco and some of your really major cities where they are having drag queens going to libraries where they are reading to toddlers and small children during library reading hour and stuff like that. So they'll have man cross dressers coming in there and reading to little kids.
It's called Dressing Up Is Fun.
Dressing them as fun.
And as I understand it, they're not coming there trying to convince the child that they are a female, but showing they're men.
You know, that beard's on and everything else.
But how dressing up can be fun. Right. And so dressing up girls is fun and things like that. And so it's really helping to, it's like attacking the long-standing moral standards of our people. And dressing up is fun and dressing up is cool and showing boys and girls, little toddlers, that you can dress up as the other gender and you can have fun doing that. It's just a fun thing to do. Brendan is speechless.
I miss those days.
Brendan is speechless.
I guess I just did not have a great childhood because I guess I missed out on that.
You did. You missed out.
I missed out my mom and dad taking me to the library and having some big, 200 or 300 pound guy with a beard, and dressed up and reading to me.
I'm sorry, Jason.
I'm sorry. I guess I was deprived.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I deprived you so bad.
But, it's amazing how quickly that has changed. In the year 2000 was the first time, I believe, in the whole world that any country legalized same-sex marriage. It was taboo. Homosexuality was taboo. Law states within the United States, it was still a criminal prohibition. And then there was obviously other countries that was still, you could be fined or in prison for being homosexual. And that was 2000, I believe, was when the first time when any country legalized same-sex marriage. And now, 17 years later, not only is it legalized, but now we have drag queens going and reading to little kids in the library. There's the whole moral degeneracy. We see it quickly changing to everything.
And I think that's always been the issue. There's always been queers around. It's not like we're just shocked to say queers are a phenomenon of this century. there's always been queers. The Bible talks about it.
Right.
You know, so they've always been around. And nobody advocates that we sneak, the government should sneak around spying in people's bedrooms. Nobody advocates that. But the thing is, a person will lead a degenerate moral, immoral lifestyle. Keep it to yourself.
Right.
Don't try to influence innocent children. And that's the thing that I think people take issue with. It isn't that I think if a queer is in the same room with me, he's going to change me. I have no fear of him doing that. But I do fear that impression of minds of children, can their minds can be altered.
And if you're having a Christian country, Christian civilization that has morals of yours, and you want your society to reflect that, then you do not allow anything that's going to degenerate the morals of society. And homosexuality is one of those primary, I mean, people don't think about race mixing, but we can get to that in a second, but homosexuality is the other great sin that is a degeneracy of our society. And it goes everything from acceptance of homosexuality to be tolerant towards that to then pedophilia, bestiality. There's all these different morals that a Christian society guards against. And then we have homosexuality that's an abomination to God and was abomination to our country. Now we look down upon it. And of course, race mixing was the very first degeneracy of the morals issue. And of course, it has been mostly accepted now in the United States. But at one time, same thing. Race mixing was a moral degeneracy. And of course, the churches, you know, at first didn't tolerate it. But in other parts of the country, they did. And then now it's accepted. And now homosexuality is just following that same path. And to me, it just always amazes me how quickly, not that it is happening, but how quickly it's happening.
Yeah. And that's how quick people seem to accept it, without any concern. And even if they don't accept it, they're afraid to speak out. They're afraid to show their real inner concerns or anger about it. They're intimidated in the silence. And because then the intimidation of silence, then give a tacit approval of it. And again, existing in our society is bad enough, but when they target children in schools, even before school, you know, in the younger, toddler ages, that's reprehensible. And yet we are considered the evil ones.
Right.
And they are to consider the ones who accept it. Just like the article, LGBT, but it teaches how to believe and love again. Really? You know, then one day talks about some queer couple in Hollywood, talks about their fairy tale romance. You know, and I don't know, I just don't. And it isn't just, I know somebody may say, well, why, you know, why do you object? What are your objections? They're not going to hurt you any. But I think thousands of years of nature, millennium, teaches that it's wrong.
Right.
Not just me saying it's wrong, or Brendan or you saying it's wrong. It's nature has told us it's wrong over thousands of years of our history.
Well, you know, we've always said that there's two laws of nature. When you're born with your race, and your racial identity, and then your sexual identity, your gender. And so when you're born male or female, and you're born either what race, you know. And when you start violating those two laws of nature, then as a Christian, that means you are going against God's plan. You're going against God's design. And that is something that is very important, and that's not something we should be tolerating. But again, like you said, Dad, you know, for thousands of years, every race, every civilization has laws, has morals that has been passed on. That's their culture. And when you're intentionally trying to destroy that culture, trying to destroy that design, to me, that is an atrocity. You know, it really is.
So, what have you been doing, Caleb, this summer? So it started 2 days
Summer started 2 days ago.
ago.
So, do you know anything? Are you smarter than you were 2 days ago? Yeah, are you?
I'm going to Boston this summer.
He's going to Boston, and we're going to go on a vacation as well, right? We're going to go to Williamsburg, Virginia.
And what's in Williamsburg, Virginia?
There's
Okay,
George
Navino.
Washington's house.
Well, that's at Mount Vernon, which is about 3 hours away from Williamsburg, Virginia.
That's pretty cool. I've been there.
Yep.
George Washington's house.
And
He's
Williamsburg.
buried there. His burial site right there. You see the cemetery where
Yeah.
he and his wife, Martha, are buried at. They're buried right there.
And George Washington is one of our heroes at our house, aren't they? And Williamsburg is one of the Colonial America is one of the first settlements within the United States. And so we're going to go there. We're going to walk through Williamsburg. Yorktown is pretty close by, where the Revolutionary War, one of the great battles, the very end of Yorktown. We're also going to be walking through that for several days and then go to Mount Vernon. See that. I don't know if we're going to be able to get to Monticello
Yeah,
or Monticello, I
it'd
should
be
say.
nice if you
It'd
could.
be nice, but that's several hours away as well.
But
So,
if not, you can probably go through Richmond
yeah,
and see St. John's Church,
right.
where Patrick Henry spoke in 1775, and where he gave that speech that ended, "Give me liberty or give me
Give me
death."
death, right.
And that might be something worth going to.
And then, of
And you can
course,
buy me a nice souvenir while you're there.
we could do that. We
You
could do
can buy
that.
one of those nice figure heads of maybe Jefferson. You know,
Yeah.
they're about 12 inches high, or like $100.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have to pay shipping, you just carry it back with you.
Yeah, it probably won't happen.
And I would be most grateful.
You probably would be grateful. Be very
You
grateful.
get one for Brendan while you're
I could do that. Brendan would like that.
Brendan probably more interested in getting one of maybe Nelson Mandela, because he's from
South
South Africa.
Africa.
You know, he's like a more like a Nelson Mandela. You don't think so?
No.
Well, you're South African, so Nelson Mandela is kind of like part of your, he's one of your homeboys.
No. No.
He's one of your national heroes, icons.
No.
No, no, no.
Now, Tayton.
We are being corrected.
We are being corrected. Now, Tayton. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. On Williamsburg, we were looking up on the computer, looking at some pictures. Do you remember anything specifically about Williamsburg?
No.
What?
The hotel, it's a apartment, but someone lived there, but now it their house turned to this big
It's
this
a plantation that's been remodeled into several apartments that you can stay at. So it's an old plantation.
has an inside pool, and at the back has a big outside pool.
You mean staying in there for the week and
Yeah,
then go
and
around
then
and do all
go
this other stuff?
right, and we're going to do that in
Yeah.
Williamsburg. And because I remember we went to it when I was a little kid, and it was really nice because you walk around all of Colonial America, the little town there, and you see all the how they lived back then, you
Yeah.
know. And it's a good
They lived,
history
those people
lesson.
lived some rough lives. You got an easy life today. They lived some rough lives back there, our colonial forefathers and so forth. They couldn't go to the store and buy milk or buy Dr. Pepper or couldn't go buy just all the things we can buy today. But they wanted, they had to make it, or they did without.
Yeah. And of course, Mount Vernon with George Washington. We have a book. It was really interesting. We have a book at our house about all the etiquettes that George Washington had time he was like
Right.
12 or 13 years old of how to eat, how to talk to people, when you should talk to them, and all that.
Be
And
polite and so forth. These were
so
actually
anyway, so every day or two throughout the week, we put that out and we read it, you know, about the things that he suggested. So, Caleb Tatum really loves George Washington. Of course, our whole family does, but they like it.
Some of those things seem a little bit silly in the modern time. And I don't know what, I can't think of any particular one right now, but most of them pretty adaptable. You
Right.
just stop and think about it. You know, just they just make common sense, you know. I know one of the things that is, it seems kind of silly, and I guess in a formal setting it would be still applied, but at home, of course, you do things at home that you don't necessarily do in a formal setting. But one thing is, if your soup is hot, you're not supposed to take a spoon and blow on it to cool it down. You're supposed to just let it sit and cool down naturally. But
yeah, you're not supposed to blow on it.
Yeah, yeah, that is considered poor etiquette. Now at home it'd be different, but maybe if you have if you're ever invited to the White House for a dinner with Donald Trump and they serve soup, Brendan, it would probably not be considered etiquette to sit there on your soup, you know. Or sip it like that.
I got coffee, so you can't sip like that. That would not be good. George Washington would say, no.
Another thing, never pick your teeth in front of people.
Right.
You know, maybe get some of your mouth, go off to the side, you know, don't pick your teeth. You know.
Nothing he, and a lot of it's just basic stuff. Like it says with children, when you address your elders, you always use Mr. and Mrs., you know, don't use a first name. I know that's always been relaxed, but the whole idea is that you are supposed to be polite, you're supposed to be courteous, you're supposed to show respect, you know. And those really was the benchmark of how he addressed people, how he spoke with people, how he just thought you should communicate with everybody. And so
one of the things that is said in there that I think is people need to apply, he says, never rejoice or show happiness or delight, whatever it is, right. How it's phrased, with the misfortune of others.
Right.
Even if it be your worst enemy.
Right.
In public. In other words, you might have your worst enemy. And I'll come, do you realize that he just broke his leg, and you're in public, you should never say, ha, 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 good, good for him.
Right.
That would be considered proper, you know. Never show delight in the misfortune of others. That was the word. Never show delight in the misfortune of others in public. Now, privately, you might say, yeah, I got it. But you don't do it publicly. Right. And because, not because it diminishes the value of the person, because it diminishes your value as a person. And so, you know, that's something people often fail to do.
Absolutely.
But there's 100 of them. Those were actually, as I understand, were actually first composed in the 1500s.
Right.
And George Washington came across them as a young man, about 10 years old, about your age. He came across them, and have you been told dismissed yet?
See, that's one of those etiquettes, is that you wait until your elders tell you when you can exit a room.
Yeah. So he came across them, and he was so impressed by them that he hand-copied them into his own tablet. And that's how learning was done back then. You know, we'll do the same thing today. It would help us. But we're in such a rush and everything. We're even in a rush to learn. But which is not necessarily a bad thing, but as I understand, back in that period of time, when people read, they just didn't read and flip the page and read another book and flip the page and read another. They'll read a page or a section, and then they'll stop. And then they'll take out their tablet, and then they'll write their own version of what they just read. They'll write it out.
And their thoughts.
And that congealed not just what they read, but their thoughts and so forth, impressed it upon their mind. And then when they wrote down all the thoughts they had, just their thoughts of what they just read, then they'll flip the page and read the next section. And I've often thought that would be a good thing for us to do today. But again, we get excited about it. We do get to the end of the book.
And there's so much information. I mean, really is.
There you might have had one book
that you would have for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a library, thousands of books.
Right. So.
And many of them I haven't read. Many of them I know the content of them because I haven't filed that way. And I have make reference to them and so on. But anyway, George Washington was an interesting character. One they really have. In fact, in the old days, you can go on the internet and see this, I believe. Some of the schools, when they would have their getting ready for the day, the headmaster would actually get them to chant, you know, George Washington, first in war, first in peace, first in the heart of his countrymen. And the youngsters would chant that, you know. And so, anyway, he was a person certainly honor and respect, but his name is being removed from schools and so forth because he's considered racist and a slaveholder, no longer worthy of honor.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
So you think these boys should be allowed to depart now, or do you think?
I guess they can. I'm not sure they really said anything that was of interesting.
Do you have any other heroes besides George Washington?
Ben Franklin.
What about you, Tate?
David Crockett.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee. You very familiar good. With David Crockett?
Yeah.
From South Africa? Yeah. Did you have a South African version?
I guarantee there was kind of similar David Crockett in South Africa.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because they were settled by
absolutely.
White pioneers.
Pioneers at all. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guarantee there would be like that. And so.
Any other heroes?
Abraham Lincoln.
Well, Abraham Lincoln, you know, that's a controversy to some people. You know, we take a little different take on it than some. Some people look upon him as a man who mastered a war against the South. You know, but Abraham Lincoln, you know, that we kind of question also. But Abraham Lincoln really went up to the bankers. And that's something a lot of people overlook. He was the only president, as far as I believe I'm correct, the only president in the history of our whole country who actually printed the constitutional money. If he would have lived and continued the process of printing our own constitutional money, it would have broke the bankers, because his money was backed by the United States,
Exactly.
And according to the Constitution, the only power that has the right to print pulling money was the Congress.
Right.
Right from the beginning, we gave that power to a bank, a central bank.
Exactly.
And Lincoln came about, and he printed constitutional money.
Right. And another thing about Abraham Lincoln that a lot of people don't understand is that he was a very big proponent and spearhead basically blacks to be reparations back to their country, to Africa. And so he was very much in favor of getting slaves back to Africa because whites, and generally in the North, did not want blacks in the United States. They want them back to Africa, you know. So he was very much a proponent and helped try to raise funds to get blacks shipped back to Africa, which we would be all in favor of.
Right. I think a lot of people, even today, a lot of people, I don't want to speak about any section of the country, but a lot of people have the idea that the South was against Negroes and had them as slaves. But the North was welcoming the Negroes, and they were saying, come on up here, enjoy our wonderful northern states.
Right.
In reality, the North didn't want them at all.
They didn't want them as slaves.
Right. And people don't stop to understand that. The North did not even want them as slaves. That's why this idea of they're a free state, they weren't a free state from the standpoint that blacks could move into Michigan or Indiana or Ohio and go to public school and engage in interracial marriage and all that sort of stuff, live where they want to. No, the northern states had strong restrictions upon blacks even moving into their state.
Right.
So there are very few blacks. That's why you drive to northern states and you drive into little tiny communities and they're all white. In the South, you drive into a little tiny community and maybe all black.
Right.
So the North had very strict restrictions on blacks immigrating into your northern states.
Yeah, and for them to even enter some of your northern states, you had to post a bond. And the bond was so high, blacks wouldn't be able to post it.
Absolutely.
So it was like, well, I guess we'll have to stay here and somewhere in the South. Because the North are like, yeah, unless you can post a $5,000 bond, you can't come in. And they're like, I don't even have a dollar. Well, sorry.
That's why the North was basically black. There were no blacks in the North until the industrial age, and especially when the age of mass production, assembly line production. Then when blacks started moving into Detroit and moving into Cleveland, that's why those changes.
After the Civil War, a huge amount, they went to the North. You know,
yeah.
Like that. But, you know, even Now, I know we're kind of digressing, but even, you know, when you hear the saying, yeah, in the South, blacks were only considered three-fifths. You know, they were only considered three-fifths of the white man. Well, the reason they were considered three-fifths because under your, in the United States Congress, for senators and representatives, you have representatives apportioned to the population. The South wanted blacks to be considered equal with the whites for Congress, you know. So you could have your southern states that have a lot of congressmen in the Washington, D.C. in order to political influence. And the North was like, no, we don't want blacks to be considered the population because they're not citizens. And so they were, did not want them to be considered as equals to whites and not be considered for the portion part of electing representatives. So that's where they compromised and says, okay, blacks will be considered three-fifths. So at that point, the South was, it was a compromise. The South wanted the blacks, you know, to be for their representatives, counted for representatives, you know. So a lot of people just, they have that idea, unfortunately, that the North is just evil and bad and they just were all welcoming blacks like that. And really, that's not the case.
No, no.
You know, in
your place like Kansas, called Bloody Kansas, you had people who were for free states and those who were for slavery. Those who were for free states, isn't there for Negroes? They didn't want Negroes brought into the community.
Exactly.
They didn't want this to become a slave state because they didn't want thousands of blacks brought into their state.
Right.
They want to keep them out of their state.
Yeah.
It wasn't there for, oh, we want blacks in our states. We want them to be free. We don't want them here. I don't care how they come.
Yeah.
We don't want them here.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like you have nowadays with cheap labor market,
yeah,
where you can have white rich white people or whatever bringing into a community, and they could bring hundreds of Mexicans. Back then, it was bring hundreds of blacks, cheap labor.
Yeah.
It lowers the economic value of that area with white people, white farmers, and white laborers, and it just cheapens your economic status of your blue-collar white workers. And so, yeah, that's why they did not want blacks into that area, you know.
Okay, Tayden, do you ever hit another hero?
Can't think of anything?
I only have one more.
What's that?
Is Daniel Boone.
Daniel Boone, good man.
Very good, man.
He led the pioneers through the Cumberland Gap.
Yep.
You know, all the way, not only that, in later life, he also explored all the way out into the western states, into like Montana and so forth.
And Daniel Boone actually was more of a frontierman
yeah.
than David Crockett. You
yeah.
know, if you actually read the history of Daniel Boone, Dane is really interesting because one of the things about Daniel Boone is there was a story where a couple white women were actually taken hostage by an Indian tribe. And Daniel Boone and a few other sailors had gone in there, snuck in there, was able to retrieve the white women from this Indian tribe. And if you ever have watched the movie The Last of the Mohicans, where it shows them coming in there, that was kind of off of the history and story of Daniel Boone. Daniel Boone was really a character that most people don't think about, but he actually was a true frontiersman.
Yeah, he's buried up there in St. Louis, isn't he?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
when I was in Boston, when inside of Grandpa's house,
right.
when we're watching TV, sometimes Daniel Boone shows comes on.
Daniel Boone
Daniel
shows?
Boone was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's in the little Daniel Boone shows.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So, all right, boys.
Okay, guys. That was nice.
Okay. See you next time. That Daniel Boone show, I've seen a time or two, but like everything else, they take care of heroes. They still kind of twist them around a little
right.
bit, you know. And they showed one show, I remember here a while back, about a year or so ago, I saw it. And had a little settlement school, all white kids. And there were one Indian kids, you know, and he's sitting there learning, you know. And then at one point, he gives a passionate speech, you know, very eloquent. You know,
yeah.
He's about 12 years old. Eloquent about How come it's always about your people and your history? How come I have to learn your? I have a history too. I have a language too. I have a people too. You know? Oh, you know. Why do we have to learn? Why is it always your history? And I thought, probably because they were the ones that did anything, you know.
Brendan, with you being raised in South Africa, I'm always intrigued with heroes of that country, of not just South Africa, but any country, you know. And in South Africa, as growing up as a little boy, were there like heroes that, you know, that kids were taught in school about South Africa, you know, with the early settlers, you know.
Not that I'm aware of.
Right.
I think growing up in 77 and going through into the 80s,
right.
There was a lot of change happening.
Right.
Although the government kept a lot of things out of libraries, things were coming in.
Right.
And so I think maybe I've lost out on some of those things. I mean, I can think of wonderful stories of the Voortrekkers, which were like the pioneers.
So I guess Jason's going to get that. What do you know about the Battle of Bloody River?
The Battle of the Bloody River, that was when the Voortrekkers had encountered with the Zulus. And that was one of the fiercest battles that were ever fought. A lot of people will, when you bring that up here in America, a lot of people, first thing that comes to mind is Shaka Zulu, mm-hmm. You know. He was not a hero of mine. however, you know, the Zulu tribe, their political party is the IFP, the Inkatha Freedom Party, and they're not as violent as the Khoisas, who were the ANC, the African National Congress, with Nelson Mandela.
But they're not Zulus.
No, they're Khoisa.
Khoisa.
It's spelled Xhosa.
Okay.
Yes. And the Khoisa are violent. They're the ones doing the necklacing, that form of punishment.
Have they always, as far as you know, has that tribe always been more violent than the Zulus?
Oh, yes.
So then it's a cultural thing. They adopted violence.
Well, yes.
They're just by nature, they've been a more violent people.
The Zulus have lived very traditionally, even with, as time has gone on, you'll find that the Khoisas will use more newer type machine guns, you know, automatic rifles. The Zulus are still with their spear and their shield. And I can remember being younger. I remember being, just as I turned 18 in the city of Johannesburg, the Zulus were protesting. And they marched onto the property of one of the headquarters of the African National Congress, was Nelson Mandela's party in Johannesburg. And they had snipers on the roof. And they started shooting. And from there, all hell broke loose. It was mass hysteria. It was...
Mm-hmm. That was between the
Khoisa and the Zulu.
Is that Khoisa or Khoisa?
Khoisa. The correct...
Khoisa.
Yeah, Khoisa. Xhosa. Mm-hmm. But the correct pronunciation is... Khoisa. You got to do the little click, you know, the little clicks you hear. Yeah.
Khoisa.
And, yeah.
I have a double accent.
Khoisa.
Khoisa. Khoisa. Khoisa. Omega or. Khoisa.
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 The Zulus,
tell me if I'm wrong or not, but I know that there was that movie. Movie was made called Zulu, which is about the battle of what was it? Rijksdorp. Yeah. Okay. And that in which the Zulus attacked an outpost, British outpost. And they were slaughtered by the Brits. Now, earlier the previous day, they had overwhelmed the British outpost and killed hundreds of them. This outpost, Rorke's Drift, Rorschach. Is that how you pronounce it?
Rorschach.
Okay, you pronounced it wrong. Anyway, Rorschach. What year was that?
I don't know, sir.
Okay. I think it was sometime in the early 1800s. And but it there showed the Zulus being pretty organized as far as their military campaign against the British. More so than just a bunch of savages running and attacking. It seemed like they were somewhat organized in some type of a, like, I don't want to say squads or battalions or commands or something. Just in the movie, they appear to be more organized. Do you know if that's true?
I would think so, because you know, the only way I believe that the Xhosa ever defeated any Zulus was because of further on with their training, whether that be in Angola or in Russia, where they got trained in camps and learned terrorism, you know, with modernized weapons and explosives.
Yeah. Huh. Well, every country has an interesting history, and I know that Blood River now, we're talking about Blood River, and that was quite a defeat for the Zulus. I mean, I don't know how many were killed, but I don't think any of the was Dutch, wasn't it? Was it a Dutch wagon train?
The Dutch, the Voortrekkers.
Yeah. I don't think any of them were killed, were they? Do you recall? I don't think any were killed, and very few even injuries. And yet thousands of Zulus, or not thousands, hundreds of Zulus were killed. And it's interesting because they knew that they were going to get attacked. As I understand the story, they had a premonition or maybe a scout. And they, prior to it, didn't they all fast and pray? It seems to me I read that, you know. Do you know, are you familiar with that at all?
Or? No, sir. That's nothing that we had learned in school.
I know Barnes Review did an article on that a couple years ago. But that was quite a battle. And there's a monument to Blood River today. Now, I don't imagine it's honored by
well, too many people. Well, it could have
been removed by it. It could have been removed.
Right.
Very well, possibly could have been.
Yeah. I mean, you got the evil white settlers coming in there attacking the innocent black families.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's
how they will look at it.
Black families.
You know, I mean, you got the blacks controlling South Africa. So I mean, why would they still have a monument there? They're going to take it down, or they'll replace it with another monument about where the evil, you know, white settlers.
Are you trying to tell me that they would take down monuments?
That I think so.
Take down monuments.
I know it's hard to believe.
I've heard they've done something like that here in America, take down some monuments.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking about it. You know, it's so scary. The only thing of South Africa left about South Africa is the name. And that'll change shortly.
Right.
You know, the flag has been taken down, the national anthem. And anything of the whole parliamentary system is very different.
Right.
You know.
Well, they've done that with all of your white African nations, where they've changed everything from the national anthems, you know, to white settlers moving out, and changing the name, you know, like Rhodesia, you know, they've changed the names, and now South Africa is just, like you said, it's just a matter of time. When will it happen? Who knows? It'll be 5 years, it'll be 10 years from now. You know, maybe they're waiting for another generation to pop up, and then we will have no identity to the old South Africa. So, hey, let's change this name, this evil name, and let's do something new and hip and modern. Yeah, that's cool.
It's difficult for people to truly understand what has happened.
Right.
I can sit all day long and tell somebody, but unless you've gone through it,
right,
you know, people don't really actually have a grip of understanding it.
Right.
And this year at that Congress, the Family Congress Conference, I plan to do a PowerPoint, and I want to show people visually. I want to show them the original South African flag and what it was replaced with.
Oh, absolutely.
And the national anthem, how, you know, authentic Dutch people would be singing it in their nice dress. And now the national anthem, which is the original national anthem was called the Stem. The national anthem is Inkosi Sikilele Africa, which means God bless Africa. And it's sung in Xhosa.
Yeah.
And it's terrible. It's horrible. And to show pictures of what has happened, you know, you have these beautiful cities a thriving city like Johannesburg. And now, you know, they changed the name from Johannesburg to Gauteng. And at the end of the registration plates, it used to be a T, which stood for the Transvaal region. But when Johannesburg became Gauteng, there was a GP standing for Gauteng province now. And people would make jokes saying it stood for Gangster's Paradise. It was terrible. It was terrible.
Well, you know, I've seen some pictures, and you ain't looking at it. You know, with the internet, just Google, you know, South Africa, 40s, 50s, 60s, and South Africa now. I mean, and people can see the pictures. I mean, you look at Johannesburg and the downtown area. I remember looking at it about a year ago. There's trash everywhere on the street. I mean, just look. I mean, it's literally a third world country,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
It's just, and then, you know, you could see some pictures of how it was in the 60s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s.
Yeah.
And it's just nice, clean, white people, you know, nice vehicles. I mean, like any typical white town you would even see in the United States in the 50s. It was the same thing there.
It was safe. It was safe.
Right.
And it was prosperous.
Right.
And what a lot of people don't know is that the currency in South Africa is called the rand. Well, for right now it is.
Until they change that.
Soon to be changed.
Right.
Coming soon. But it was the South African rand. And a lot of people are familiar with the Kruger rand, but the currency was rand. And the rand was very powerful. And the rand, although because the world held sanctions against us because of our apartheid, we weren't recognized on the international financial globe charts. What your currency is worth. And we've always known that the British sterling pound was up there. Well, the rand was right next to it. I mean, you got to figure there was De Beers that mined 86% of the world's diamonds. There was gold, platinum, iron ore that was shipped to the Far East to make car engines for the world, never to mind the wheat and fruits and wines.
Yeah.
And you know, so we, even though the world held sanctions against South Africa, we were self-sufficient. We didn't
right.
need anything. You know, I remember little things disappearing like Kodak film. We couldn't get that, you know, little
right.
things. But you know, we had our own things that we could,
yeah.
you know, do. And we're a prosperous country, rich, very safe. And those things are gone now.
Right.
Those things are gone.
Yeah. And same with every major city in this country.
Yeah.
And soon the country itself.
Yeah. It's like I've said, you know, and I've heard, you know, the way I say South Africa is a blueprint
right.
for what's going on in the world and what's going to possibly happen here in America.
Right. Right. You know, and
Detroit is the perfect. Detroit is the perfect example.
Yep.
They're one of the most prosperous cities in the nation. And it was a worker's paradise. And today it's been destroyed. Everybody knows that. It's,
right.
it's not safe to walk the streets of Detroit.
Well, yeah, and now it's almost common, but now they have bus tours of the ruins of Detroit.
You can go on YouTube, watch the ruins of Detroit.
Yeah, but you actually take a tour of it. Through Detroit to look at all the ruins of Detroit, the buildings that's collapsed. And like, this is where this major company was. And this is where this prosperous community was. It's the ruins of Detroit. And you see all the, it's like, and literally you're driving through and it's like going through like a bombed area of some like Iraq or Afghanistan.
You almost feel like you may be at Disney World on a ride from
yeah.
a movie or something.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
today, if I may say what we're going to do, going to go down to the protest.
I would say it's more of a victory celebration.
I'm not sure what he did.
But here in Harrison, the Redneck Revolt, which has about 26, 27 chapters in the United States, they're an anti-white, anti-Christian group. And,
well, they don't say that, though.
But that's what they are.
They're for the working man.
Yeah, but that's what they are. They're
sure.
very, very much they're anti-white. I mean, their agenda, propaganda. And so they have different chapters in the United States. They have one, I guess, in Mountain Home, probably has two or three members. It's not very big. But they have posted on their webpage or Facebook page that they were going to come to Harrison. And this was in the end of April, and they were going to have a protest on the square on the same weekend that we were having our National Faith and Freedom Conference. So they were doing this in response to the Faith and Freedom Conference of the Knights Party and the Christian Revival Center
and billboards
and like that. And, of course, once they made that announcement, there was such an uproar from the local community against them coming here in Harrison, because Harrison is a white town. It's a Christian town. They don't, for the most part, people don't want Harrison to reflect those of Pine Bluff or Memphis or any of your major non-white cities. Harrison's a good town. And so there was an uproar, and eventually they canceled.
These were not political activists.
No, these were just people in the community.
Yeah, Harrison has a website. I shouldn't say Harrison, but there are a couple of websites, not websites, Facebook pages.
Facebook.
That centers around Harrison gossip and Harrison news and that sort of thing. And then people could post that. And people going on there like, well, the redneck, what redneck? They're not rednecks. I'll show them what redneck is when they come down here.
Yeah, they're going to come to our community. come to our community and try to change Harrison. Yeah. We'll be down there. And so there was such an uproar about
it. The local citizens. They were political activists.
No, and so they, so this redneck revolt, they canceled and said, "Well, we're not going to show up."
Because of the threats.
Because of the threats. But there was no threats at all. It was just people upset that you're having basically outsiders trying to come into Harrison and trying to change Harrison. And so,
there's the one thing you say, there might be people in Harrison who don't like the Klan.
There are, right.
But they can't call us outsiders.
Right. Absolutely not. And so, anyway, so today, May 27th, there's a protest. I would like to refer more as a victory celebration that's going to be conducted in Harrison. And it'll be Confederate flags. But it's a victory celebration that will be there in Harrison. It's going to be at the mall, which is right by Highway 65, and of course it will be really good because it's Labor Day or Memorial Day weekend, so there'll be a lot of cars driving by, and so there'll be a lot of people out there celebrating as a result of these people not coming in and trying to change Harrison.
And I've seen on television, just watching, you know, they show the Antifa,
right,
and they show these extreme leftist groups being very violent, and they show people that are supposedly Republicans or Christians that have been attacked, blood on the face. And I think it's, you know, to almost promote fear, like, you know, get away from these people.
Oh, yeah. All right.
And when I was reading in my Bible this morning, I went into Psalms, and it was Psalms 27. And because I was thinking about the fear of that they try and storm the people. And it says here, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked, even mine enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat up my flesh, they stumbled and fell."
Yeah. Psalm 27.
1 and 2.
Right.
And I just, that really inspired me because, you know, I'm not by any means afraid to go down there.
Right.
But I maybe someone hearing this thinks twice about, oh, I don't want to get hurt.
Right.
People get scared sometimes.
Sure.
And if that can help somebody,
right,
you know.
Well, it's like anything else. I mean, there's always circumstances where anything can happen. For the vast majority, I would say 95% of the time, there's never issues. There's never problems with people protesting or going out there and, you know, raising the American flag or the Confederate flag, voicing their support of our racial identity. There's always those ifs. There's always that statistic where, yeah, something could happen. But, you know, what's the alternative? You know, the alternative is not standing up for your people. And there's various ways people can stand up for your people, stand for your culture. I mean, a lot of people think, okay, well, stand out on the side of the street, you know, with a American flag or Confederate flag. Well, you stand up by, you know, talking to people. You can stand up by donating and tithing, very vitally important. You can stand up by being faithful on listening to programs and getting on social media and writing to letters to the editors. There's a lot of way of standing up, you know. But so often people have that idea of, not only, let's say, getting beaten up, because I know that's what you were kind of referring to, but people just have that fear of doing anything. You know, just they basically have self-censored themselves, where they're afraid even to talk to people, to say anything, just keep it to themselves, and that's it. And that's the worst case scenario.
One of the best things that I got prepped by you, Pastor Rob, is when I got to vote for the first time this year for Donald Trump. And you said, you know, don't become complacent because Trump is in office now. You know, and I haven't. I haven't become complacent because he's man. Right. Man will fail us.
Right.
And, you know, we've got to fight the good fight.
Sure.
And,
yeah. Well, ultimately, as Christians, we have a duty and obligation. You know, we don't know the big scheme of things that God has planned, but we do know that God is going to be victorious. We know that individually we have to be faithful and committed to ourselves so that we can stand up. But we also have to be faithful and committed to our culture and our race and to God. And if we do that, then we are going to win. You know, now, will the countries continue to be, you know, go down, you know, the toilet bowl? It could. But as individuals, we are being faithful and committed. And if we know that great understanding of the relationship that we have with the covenant people in the Bible, then we know that we're going to be standing on the right side of God.
Yes.
Right. And that's what we have to look at.
We don't know what opportunities are going to open up to.
Absolutely.
We have no idea. I mean, we look at the situation today, it looks dark and bleak, obviously. And yet there are good signs. You know, there is an awakening in the country.
Right.
Maybe not to where we want it to be, but there is an awakening. It's revealed itself in the Donald Trump election. So, and we don't know what kind of opportunity is going to present itself. And so we have to stand faithful, not only for ourselves, but we got to stand faithful for those people who are looking at us or watching us. People we have influence over, our children, our neighbors' children, or children of our friends who need mentors, who need somebody to stand bravely and courageously. And so we need to stand there in whatever capacity God has given us. It may, for some people, may be standing on the street corner past, in a demonstration. Somebody else might be writing letters or calling on talk shows or sharing things on social media. For other people, it may be putting a check in the envelope, and that people think, well, yeah, what does that do? Well, when you do that, let your kids see what you're doing. Let them be aware of it. Let them know that this is important. There's all kinds of things, so we can't judge. I know sometimes people consider themselves activists, wants to judge other people and say, well, you're not on the street with me. Why aren't you there? I'm an activist. But there's all kinds of ways to be activist.
Absolutely.
Just being faithful in the capacity God has placed you. The mother who teaches her children to love his heritage, love his culture, to love its people, who maybe never get out of the street corner, but faithfully teaches that child, is a more of an activist than somebody whose only reason he's on the street corner is because he wants to rush.
Right.
He really don't care about the people. He just wants the thrill and the rush.
Right.
And then goes back home and pounds his chest that he's an activist.
It doesn't do anything for the rest of the week or a month or a year.
Correct. So, you know, we can't stand in judgment of others who don't do what we think should be done. Everybody has capacity to fill, and as long as they fulfill it.
Well, you know, that's why I think that the Nice Party really is a great organization. And to me, I think it's a program, the Nice Party. We always consider ourselves, you know, the premier voice of the white people, of the white resistance, I should say. And I think the reason we say that is because so often people will say, we got to get out there and we got protests, you know, here, you know, and get on the street corner, or because that's just what most people say when they think you're an activist. That's just what you do. But then it's like, okay, yes, I mean, people's been doing that since the 20s and 30s, okay? So nothing discounting that. But what's the long-term goal? What's the long-term agenda? What is your blueprint in reclaiming America? What is that? Okay, I mean, you can't reclaim America just by standing up with a flagpole all the time. You're not going to reclaim America, you know? I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's a good thing. I mean, a lot more people should be doing that. But there has to be something beyond that. And to me, that's why the Nice Party is really a unique and great organization because we understand that. We understand that there's a long-term goal here, and we can't just look at the tree. We have to look at the forest behind the tree. And in order to do that, you know, the Knights Party has programs that really looks at that long-term goal. You know, we have members that distribute literature and that participate in protests. But we have an agenda and a program, and part of that is here being connected with the Christian Revival Center, where we have a headquarters. We do have a publication. We do have a long-term goal with the Youth Corps. We do have a goal with teaching teenagers to come here to headquarters and teach them how to be a person of influence in their communities. We know long-term-wise, there's a program and a plan that has to be set in motion to reclaim America. And so that's what we've been doing, and that's what we've been, you know, struggling for 30, 40 years and putting this program in place. And we see that. We see the fruitation of it. We see the great opportunities that's happening, especially within the Knights, with all our outreach projects. And it's just not of literally just standing, you know, with on the street corner, you know, passing out literature or just having a Confederate flag, and then at the end of the day you go home and you don't do anything else for another couple months or a year. You know, we have people in the Knights and the associates throughout the United States that understands that, and so, and I think that's what really sets us apart and sets us unique from most white racialist organizations, because they don't think about that.
Well, so often I've seen over the years, I've been around this for a long time, we've had people have the attitude that if you're not going to get out of the street to be activists with us, then we don't want you.
Right.
And, you know, an orchestra is made of many instruments. Not everybody plays the trumpet. Not everybody plays the drums. Not right. Everybody, you know, plays the clarinet. Everybody plays a different instrument. And it's the same thing with the political movement. Not everybody does the same thing. You need all kinds of people involved doing the right kind of, doing the thing that they feel led to do. And they might be inspired to do something different later on. But nevertheless, they're all fulfilling a responsibility. Whether it's the person who's purchasing the uniform for the band, or person who's selling tickets at the concert hall, or whether it's the person who's playing the instruments, or whether it's the conductor leading the orchestra, or whether it's the person who's setting up the stage, or the person sweeping the floor after the concert is over.
Right.
You know, they're all doing a part. Yes. And we need to appreciate every part they do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's got to be a well-oiled machine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and I so often, and unfortunately, then, you know, you have people in the, you know, racialist movement that they do their tour of duty. You know, they're in there 3, 4, or 5 years. You know, and it's hard work. When you're in the racialist movement, you're attacked not by physical attack, but you're attacked by maybe families or friends. And you might be spending money to, you know.
If you're somebody who's trying to get out the street all the
time. Yeah, you're, you know, and it can be somewhat negative because of the fact that it takes time, takes effort, and takes work. And so people, after 3, 4 years, they kind of get tired and it's like, oh my gosh, this ain't worth it, you know, because they don't see any results. And then they quit. Doesn't mean they stop believing. They just may quit doing the activity, you know. And so often people, they're in that short window of 3 or 4 years and they don't understand the long-term goal. And so if they're around someone who's saying, hey, you got to get out there and kind of repeat the program of protesting, holding a flag and all that, in their mind, that's just all you do. That's all you do, you know, in 3 or 4 years, you do that, you get tired. You get,
and the thrill's gone.
The thrill's gone, you know, it's not that funny anymore, you know, it's like, oh, this actually takes work, you know. And like I said, it's not that they stop believing, they don't do it anymore. And I think that's what really sets the Knights apart, is because we understand our goal is winning the war, not winning the skirmish. And so we look at that long-term goal. You know, and, you know, as an attorney, I talk to my clients all the time on cases. I say, you can't look at the small little victories or the fights, you know, in the court case. You got to look at that long-term goal. What's your goal? that's what you want to win. You know, if the other side might get this short little victory on
they get the doghouse.
Yeah. I said, you know, don't worry
about
that.
You had people do that, fighting over who gets the doghouse.
Yeah, you know, it's like, don't worry about that. What's that long-term goal? And so that's what, unfortunately, people don't understand. People say, we got to retake America. We got to, you know, reclaim America. We got to win it. We got to fight. And we got to do. Yes, we agree with that. But how are you going to do it? You know? And so part of that is building an organization, having the like I said, the plans and the blueprints on achieving that. And the Knights have that. You know, that's what really makes us unique.
And that's what I believe is so inspirational about the conferences right. that we host here, is that people have said they've been spiritually, politically inspired
right.
and know what to do. Some people don't know what to do.
Exactly.
And those who think they know what to do are doing the wrong thing.
right.
But when they realize, you know, that screaming white power, but not giving anything
right.
to build it,
right.
they realize all the projects, the Christian Research and Development Center.
Right.
The billboards that are up, the printing that goes up for the people to distribute costs money.
Absolutely.
And not that the Knights Party ever makes a profit on anything
right.
like that. So,
but it still costs money.
It still costs money.
I'm looking for a printer that says I will do all your printing.
yeah. And that's why people out there, tithing and supporting is to me, is like almost, they are the most important people.
It's hard to give of yourself.
Right.
Money is given of yourself.
Right.
You work hard in a job to make an income. If you come home with your check at the end of the week, that is your, in a sense, that is your money to use to pay for your home, groceries, clothing on the kids, all the things that gives you, in a sense of power.
Right.
I don't mean that in a negative way, but that money represents power to secure your life.
Right.
And when you give of that, you're really giving of yourself.
Absolutely.
Fulfill the responsibility of the tithing and giving and offerings. You're really giving of yourself. You're giving something that is of you. And that's really important. People go to the rallies and just scream and holler. They're not really giving of themselves. They're receiving a thrill.
Right.
They're receiving the rush.
It's entertainment. It's almost entertainment.
Yeah. They're receiving. They're not giving. And I'm not against those things. I participated in many. I'm going to be in this afternoon. It'll be, you know. So those things are good. We just can't limit it to that.
Right.
That's the point I'm getting at.
Absolutely. And so
that's a lot of time.
So yes, yeah. So anyway, so this hour has gone by quickly.
Absolutely. Well, okay, we're going to wrap it up for today. We'll be back in next week. Be sure to spread this on social media. Tell your friends and neighbors about the Knights Party.
And those Knights Party members, make sure you're putting on your schedule to be here at our Knights Party Family Congress, September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. I believe
right,
it's Labor Day
right.
weekend. Put it on your calendar and just say, I'm going to be there. And you can go to, I believe, KKK.com. You can get the registration in there. And we always encourage, bring your family. Bring your family. This is a family conference.
Yeah. Don't show up by yourself. Bring your whole family.
Yeah. And just to confirm on that, just being in the office the last couple of weeks, lots of calls coming in, lots of families, a lot of people we know, a lot of new people, and it's going to be a good turnout.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
3-day family-filled fun time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yes.
All right, then September 1, 2, and 3, mark your calendar right now, and then make the plan to be here. It's just a decision.
It is.
All amounts to. Well, until next time, this is Thomas Robb.
And Jason Robb. And
Brendan Warner.
And Caleb and Tate have left the building. So we're reminding you to love your God and love your people.